sign that dominates rare earths. Why are we putting this stuff in a boat to send it to China to make it for us? So the narrative has always been fairly strong from a security perspective. Today, that stockpile isn't sufficient to support the military in a major conflict. And it basically targets enough inventories for a one-year conflict with China based on various war games and scenarios. We are battling China. You know, this is not only a pacing threat for the military, but a commercial threat for the country.
Hey, welcome back to the MWI podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and on this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Morgan Bazilian. He is the director of the Payne Institute for Public Policy at the Colorado School of Mines, and much of his work really sits at the intersection of national defense policy and natural resources. So if we want to talk about critical minerals and their importance to the defense industrial base, or about Chinese control over much of the world's rare earth mineral supply chains, or why certain elements are essential to building F-35 fighter aircraft, for example, Morgan is the perfect person to have that discussion with. And it's the discussion that you'll hear on this episode. Before we get to it, as always, a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Dr. Morgan Bazilian. Morgan, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the MWI podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you are the director of the Payne Institute for Public Policy at the Colorado School of Mines, which means that you kind of sit at this interesting nexus of public policy, including national security and national defense policy, and, you know, all things sort of environmental and natural resources. And it's a really fascinating intersection. So, you know, we're going to talk about how natural resources and things of that nature sort of factor into discussions about national defense and national security policy. But I kind of want to start by giving listeners maybe a window into your background, because I was ahead of this episode, I was reading a little bit about your bio, and it's a very long bio with a very long list of affiliations and some really fascinating, you know, prior work experience. So I wonder if you could just sort of introduce yourself to listeners.
Sure. My pleasure. Thanks, John. The reason the bio is long is because I'm getting old, but I've been roughly in energy and specifically energy security for the duration of my career. So, you know, at least 30 years now. And I'm new to academia, or new in the time frames of academia. That is, I've been at the Colorado School of Mines for about 6 years. The School of Mines is a small public research STEM university, and we can get back to that. I joined the university from the World Bank, where I was in the energy and extractives group. What that means is roughly making investments globally in energy infrastructure with a focus on economic development for the countries that choose to take those loans or grants. And before that, I worked briefly on energy security issues at the National Renewable Energy Lab, which is now behind me as I speak to you, about a mile as the crow flies. And before that, I was in the United Nations working on energy and poverty, or energy and access, as it's called there, which means helping countries and their economies and their people to gain access to affordable and secure and resilient energy systems, energy services, which, you know, is just a means to an end. And the end is economic development, economic freedom, and security for the most part. And before that, there's another list of other jobs and affiliations, mostly in Europe. So I worked across Europe in several capacities, again, primarily on energy security. And I wrote a book that no one's bought called Energy Security and Diversity. It was analytical methods for energy diversity and security. And it's mostly an academic work on how we can apply analytical methods to understand security better. And these days, just to bring us back to this discussion, I have been applying some of those same analytical frameworks and policy insights to critical minerals and security. And so currently in my role here at the School of Mines, we have several different initiatives at the Payne Institute. The Institute was started when I joined, and the idea was to connect the technical expertise at the university to context, which means to the rest of the world. Sure. So maybe I'll stop there, John.
Yeah, as I mentioned, it's a long and really fascinating bio, and we haven't even scratched the surface of your past as a mountaineer and a professional mountain guide. Okay, so the reason that I asked you to come on the podcast today is because I think this is a really interesting, broadly speaking, a really interesting subject. But you've written a few things that we've had the opportunity to publish, including most recently an article on effectively China's weaponization of its dominance of the rare earth mineral supply chain, so to speak, and how the U.S. can sort of respond and protect itself against some of the risk that is associated with, you know, that weaponization. And so I think what we'll do is we'll kind of start with the conversation with that subject, with rare earths, and their, you know, I guess the implications for national defense policy, and then maybe zoom out and talk about some of the other things that you're kind of uniquely well suited and well equipped to answer. So I guess to sort of, you know, level bubbles, so to speak, when we talk about rare earths, what minerals are we talking about specifically?
Yeah, thanks, John. So I might actually turn to, we had the honor to publish in the Modern War Institute a couple times prior to this most recent one. And so let me just take it from there, because those articles were slightly more general. So the topic area we're talking about is called critical minerals. That's what it's called in the mainstream media, and that's what it's typically called in political circles. The United States has three different lists of what a critical mineral is, what these things are. One from the USGS, the Geological Society, or the Department of Interior, one from the Department of Energy, and one from the Department of Defense. And I say this not just because I'm on a podcast from West Point, but the Department of Defense lists is the most sophisticated, and I'll tell you why I think that. The two other lists are static in time and primarily deal with just minerals, so not final products.
Okay.
The Department of Energy has some materials, which I would classify as, you know, on the way towards final products. And the department, and they're static in time. In other words, they just look at today. And they're very supply, all three are very supply focused. What that means is we're taking a fairly simple algorithm and saying, where do we get this stuff, and do we like or trust these people? In other words, are we going to be able? And of course, the elephant in the room, or the named elephant in the room, is China, and we can get back to that. The Department of Defense list takes a more forward-looking scenario approach. What that means is you look at your pacing threat, or the United States pacing threat in China and China's military, and say, what if there's a conflict with China or South China Sea? And how does that impact our need for materials? And so that's the current DOD list.
How long is that list? So
the USGS list has roughly 50 things in it. The DOE list has, I believe, 23. And the DOD is somewhere in between there.
Okay.
And I can talk about the DOD, in my view, has the most sophisticated approach to critical minerals overall. So I can say what that means. But just getting back to our article on rare earths, rare earths are a subset of critical minerals. So the rare earths are, if you look on a chart of the elements, they are 15 elements plus two. We don't have to get into that, but they're a subset of the critical minerals. So if you have 50 critical minerals on the USGS, that includes 17 rare earths. Rare earths tend to make the news more, I think largely because of the optics. It's just an attractive phrase. In other words, it sounds cool. And we can get into why we care about them. And I think at some point in the conversation, the arc is that we've thought about critical minerals as a country and as a Department of Defense for a very long time. We've had a national stockpile, I think, since 1939, so during World War II. We have something called the Defense Production Act, which is a way to get materials we need, and that's been in place since the Korean War. And we can talk about how it applies today, but very recently, and part of the topic in the most recent essay we did for you was that the Department of Defense made by far their largest investment into one of these things. It happened to be into rare earths, and in a very interesting way. In other words, there were several different financial mechanisms utilized to secure these minerals, materials, and magnets in this case, so a final advanced product, if you will. And so it was essentially a step change to what's happened before, or at least since wartime, at least since the end of World War II. So that has made national, even international news, and we can go into the details of that as you like.
Yeah, we'll certainly talk about that because, you know, you certainly when we were in the process of putting the final edits on that piece when that announcement was made, and you kind of impressed upon me how big a deal that is. So I do want to kind of get into some of the details, but sort of zooming out again, because, you know, for a pretty broad and diverse listener base, I just want to make sure we're all on kind of the same page in terms of the conversation. If we're talking rare earths, this is a subset of critical minerals. Is that a useful distinction, or is the fact that we sort of, does that maybe artificially inflate their importance vis-a-vis the other, or in comparison with the other critical minerals? Is it more important to think broadly about this larger list of critical minerals?
Yeah. So it not only is it important to think of a wider context of critical minerals, but even more important probably is to think across entire supply chains to final products. Sure. So, and that's why the Department of Defense has been really good on this is, you know, if the U.S. Navy, you know, in their 2024 budget, you know, wants to grow the force to over 500 ships, and the Air Force wants another 100 aircraft, including 50 or 40 F-35s, and the land forces in the Indo-Pacific want lots of long-range precision rockets, missiles, and artillery, then we need the whole supply chain to be understood, not just the rocks, if you will, not just the ores that are being mined. And so that's why I think this rare earths example that we have now, the Department of Defense, a significant investment into a company called MP Materials is illustrative and highlights some of the issues. There are, of course, risks in that investment, both commercial risks and delivery risks, but it does show a specific pain point the department identified with both the rare earth materials and the magnets that go into everything from the submarine classes to the F-35s, and that we are battling China. You know, this is not only a pacing threat for the military, but a commercial threat for the country. So that I think you have to look across supply chains and across final uses or end uses for these things. The reason I say that is because the analogies that are attractive to use or easiest to use in some cases are to oil and gas. So there's a lot of analogies to the energy sector from the critical mineral sector, but it, like all analogies, they're imperfect. And so when we're talking about critical minerals, we're talking about, say, 50 different things that turn into 5,000 different things or 5 million different things. And each one has a different supply chain, a set of stakeholders, a set of risks, a set of markets and size. And so with critical minerals, largely we're talking about fairly small or very small markets, say compared to oil, but even compared to other things. And so even the critical minerals lists are not comprehensive themselves. So, you know, we still want to talk about steel. We just put out a deep dive into steel. Steel's very important for the military, of course, for all those components I already mentioned, from subs to jets to artillery.
But less important now than vis-a-vis, you know, these other things, because you mentioned the national defense stockpile, for instance. Yeah. When that was created, it was almost entirely or mostly about steel, because that's what you needed to build fighter aircraft, to build tanks, things like that. Now we're talking about magnets that didn't exist because we didn't need them, and things that are dependent on the rare earth. So I guess how novel is this problem, A, is my first question, and B, how much do we actually know about the Earth's supply of some of these minerals? Because, you know, you hear facts and figures thrown out there like, oh, China controls access to 90-some% of the known stocks of some, you know, some mineral or another. You know, is it a case that we're pretty certain that that's true, or that there could be vast untapped stockpiles someplace, you know, sort of the functional equivalent of the U.S. finding the oil fields in the Western Dakotas, you know, a number of years ago, and completely changing the way we thought about global oil supply from a U.S. demand perspective?
Yeah. So let's tackle that supply issue, which means, you know, where do we get this stuff and where does it come from? The potential for materials in the Earth's crust is not limitless, of course, but it's enormous. Mm-hmm. And so then you have to go into the mining industry and what drives the mining industry and investment in mining and exploration. And that's a detailed discussion about one sector. The answer is that there's plenty of this stuff. It depends on how companies or the government are incentivized to get it. And so, you know, is it economic to get product X? Well, then you have to go to your board meeting and decide what the price of product X is going to be in a few years. And can you get the permits to get it? And then where's the market competition? And so, the answer to the last question is the market competition is China in almost every case. And the issue with the China's dominance, such a popular word these days, is not just in their geological bounties of these things, which are not necessarily unique. The United States has lots, Canada has lots, and Australia has lots, et cetera. Is there long-term planning? I'm talking decades here, several decades, around the sector itself and thinking in terms of supply chain. So they do dominate the mining often of these things, but not in all cases. But they, in almost all cases, they dominate what energy people call the midstream, but mining people tend to call processing and refining, which means turning the ore into something usable as a material or a chemical.
Sure.
And that area, there's no question that they dominate. We ceded that domination to them after World War II. It was uneconomic, remains uneconomic to do that in the United States, to do this processing and refining, and environmentally pretty tough. And so you lost the social license. You lost the ability to put these things up because the communities didn't want it. And China took that up. And then there's the even sort of less sexy topic, if you will, about workforce, we not only ceded the market to them, but we also ceded all the workforce. So we rarely train people in the magic arts of metallurgy. We do at the School of Mines. But so I think it's a really important part for your listeners that we, you know, before this deal with MP Materials, MP Materials is 8%, still is 8% owned by a partially owned Chinese state company, and they were shipping their product, these what are called light rare earths, to China. They've now agreed with the Department of Defense investment to stop that and start doing separation here in the United States, both light and heavy rare earths. And I guess the most important part, in my view, of the defense investment in MP was the agreement, the offtake agreement, a demand side thing where they said, we'll take all of the magnets you produced out of this new factory. So that gives the company, and then it gave the private sector the ability to say, okay, the DoD's all in on this. They're going to take a board seat. They are going to take an offtake agreement. And then Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, in a very well orchestrated PR piece with the Department of Defense and Apple afterwards, are talking about billions of dollars, or in Apple's case, $500 million. But in Goldman and JP Chase, billion or more. So that's the way, I think it's a good way to think about it, and a good way for your listeners to understand this. But going back to your original question, the whole market, you know, what you hear often is don't be so hyperbolic. This isn't that big of a deal. We're only talking about a $200 million market overall for some of these rare earths. Yes, that's true. It is not, it's a fraction, orders of magnitude less than the oil market. But, you know, we've identified, and it's no longer hyperbole, a security gap in the supply chain. And that gap was empirically evident before this Department of Defense investment, in as much as automakers and some of the, it's harder to get data, of course, but some of the larger defense contractors actually ceasing or talking about ceasing production of various products because they didn't have access to certain rare earths or magnets because of Chinese export controls. So I'm trying to give you a full picture. Sometimes that's more annoying than talking about the specifics, but it's important to have the whole value chain to understand it.
No, that's really, I mean, I think it's really important and really interesting. So thank you. But so effectively, if you're Beijing, if you're the Chinese Communist Party, you can direct any firm, based effectively any state owned or state backed firm to do this, even if it's not likely to be profitable, and they just have to do it. In the US case, it's a little bit different, right? And so effectively, this investment and the offtake agreements to commit to buying everything is sort of an insurance policy so that companies feel comfortable that they're not going to bankrupt themselves by launching these massive investments that are required in something that might otherwise not be very profitable. Is that correct?
Roughly. So I'm just going to change a couple of your terms be specific, which is, it's not so much the companies going bankrupt, it's the ability to get any private financing. So when you go to a private company to get billions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars, that what they do is a relatively simple, no offense to the finance community, relatively simple screening for what their risk is and therefore what their cost of capital is. And then they need to know what these products are worth. And so just to break that down a little bit, in a lot of the critical minerals markets, there is not a decent price. There's no place you can go to actually get what we would call real price discovery, because the markets are small, they're opaque. In other words, you can't see what's happening. And it's hard to find the price. You know, is it priced in US dollars? Is it priced in yuan? Where is it traded, etc.? And what's happened in some of these markets is the Chinese can manipulate the market. We can go into how they're doing that by stockpiling and also just dumping. But if you're if you're an American company or you're a company anywhere, and you go to your board and you say, the board asks you, what's the price of this stuff tomorrow or in 5 years? And, you know, is it a decent market? You have to say, I have no idea what the price is, or not a great idea. And no, the market's not transparent and it can be manipulated. And if you go to a bank with that proposition, they'll just say no. And keep in mind, when you're going to these banks, their money is fungible, which means that it could go anywhere, into anything. And it's tending not to go into mining. Mining itself is not, these days, a terribly attractive investment in most cases, even for primary things like copper and ore, let alone for smaller things. And so I'm just putting a little bit of a finer point on that. They call it a capital stack. In other words, you got to go to the market and say, here's my capital stack. And if you have the DoD on your team, well, that helps a lot.
Sure.
But what the DoD did in this case, in the MP case, was not just an equity position. So they actually bought stock, controlling stock, 15% of the company once it's converted. The Chinese company had 8%. So now they're in control. They also had this offtake agreement we discussed briefly, and they had a price floor for the actual neodymium, the stuff, the mineral, and they have loans for processing and refining, separating both the light and the heavy rare earths. And a lot of the stuff has come through the Defense Production Act, which we can talk about. But I just wanted to put a finer point on some of the financial mechanisms for this stuff. And lastly, just to say, while it's true that China can do a lot of state-directed things with their corporations that we cannot do, their corporations also go through an enormous amount of internal competition. So it's not like it's easy. And I think the more important point might be that they have the ability to plan long term, and mm-hmm. we do not. And they have, and therefore, in any infrastructure play, what you need is some remote level of certainty. That's what any banker, company CEO would always ask for, which never happens, but you can ask for it. Theirs is a lot better than ours in terms of that long term planning horizon.
You mentioned the Defense Production Act, as well as I want to talk about that. But first, I want to touch on the National Defense Stockpile, right? This is this thing that was, hey, in an emergency, we're going to need a lot of raw materials in order to reconstitute military equipment, in order to keep the fight going in a sustained conflict. That's something that we're thinking about again for the first time in a while, that as a, you know, a defense enterprise, that we're thinking about how to be able to do that stuff. But the sort of terms have changed. Like we said, it's not just having enough steel. It's, you know, your article mentioned something that I honestly did not know, that was an F-35 requires 900 pounds of certain rare earths in order to complete. A Virginia class submarine has something like, you know, 9,000 pounds or something in it for these high tech magnets that are required. So you made the argument in this article that it isn't just about having the raw materials, it's about also stockpiling sort of finished products. Can you talk a little bit about what would be required in order to, you know, to get the National Defense Stockpile up to where you think it would need to be in order to sustain long-term, protracted, large-scale combat?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And this idea of a stockpile has risen up the political prioritization quite dramatically, maybe in the last 2 years. So as we went into the last election cycle, both candidate Harris and current President Trump team both discussed the need for stockpiles. I think it comes as I think it has some attractive optics. You know, it sounds good, right? We're going to do something and we're going to stockpile this stuff. And again, the analogy tends to be to oil and gas, in this case, the National Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which has mm-hmm. been around for a while. And actually, there's an international system for Strategic Petroleum Reserve, largely coordinated, not run, but coordinated by something called the International Energy Agency, which was basically started for energy security purposes in 1973 in a stockpile for emergencies. Different countries have it in different ways, either physical or financial. In other words, tickets or options to buy this stuff. And I make that analogy to the SPR, the petroleum reserve, because it's been in the news for 60 years, and it's been in the news for every single election because, as you know, U.S. voters care deeply about the price of gasoline. Now, I don't believe that mineral stockpiling or critical minerals will rise to the level of oil and gasoline as far as political priorities, because they're not likely to play a role in elections to the same degree. But the petroleum stuff is highly political. Now, the National Defense Stockpile in the United States exists. If we go back to the Cold War, that's when it hit its peak. In 1962, we saw that the reserve was worth over $70 billion, $75 billion adjusted money. 200 locations, warehouses, big volume materials, aluminum, copper, lead, etc. Today, that stockpile isn't sufficient to support the military in a major conflict. And it basically targets enough inventories for a one-year conflict with China based on various war games and scenarios and a three-year recovery. But it's worth less than $1 billion now in six locations. So that's where we sit now. And so the political idea is, well, how do we change that? How do we go from something that just serves the possibility of war for a short time to something that would be useful in this, existing trade war with China? Now, keep in mind, of course, China also stockpiles stuff. And they provide minerals to sectors during emergencies. And what it does is, or how they use it, is to influence prices in some cases. So in 2016, China purchased copper at depressed prices from smelters. That means where you do something with the copper, where you process, refine the copper in a smelter to keep them going operationally. And I'd like to come back to that because it's relevant today to the United States. They've done it more recently. In 2021, they released copper from the stockpile to shield their manufacturers from prices. So, as the price of copper goes up and down, they've been playing in that market. Some would say gaming or ruining it, but from their perspective, they are taking care of their own national security, whether it's economic or military. And so that was the idea, I think, from both the Harris campaign and the Trump then campaign, to say, how can we use this in an economically strategic way for both military and commercial sectors? It turns out that it's going to be really, really expensive and very, very difficult to make much of an impact on the commercial sector, unless you're willing to manipulate markets and spend a huge amount of money like China is. So I'm not sure, or it seems unlikely to me, that we will actually get to the point of making it so it is a commercially, strategic political tool as
opposed the stockpile,
as opposed to what I think we should remain is building it up, but with a focus on the military, with a clear focus on the military. And that's exactly, again, what the DOD is doing with this MP materials, and in a better way, maybe. So if we think about stockpiling as keeping stuff on the supply side, keeping ores or chemicals that could be stored for a while, versus, do we just try to create better full supply chains that we know are resilient and secure? the latter, which is roughly what the MP materials thing is supposed to do, is almost certainly a better way to address security as a holistic concept rather than just a supply side thing.
The MP deal that we've mentioned a few times is the U.S. government, DoD, kind of acting, you know, unilaterally in a certain sense. But there are a lot of countries that don't have even the resources to be able to do something like this. Many of them are allies and partners of the United States. Is there virtue in making this a more multilateral effort over the long term to build those supply chains and sort of share responsibility with other close allies and partners? You mentioned Australia, European allies, what have you.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you ask that question to an academic, the answer is yes, you're correct. You know, and they would tell you that various modeling or analytical work from political science or economics or international relations, or even security studies would tell you that, and the DoD knows this better than any department, that, you know, when possible, you fight wars or you fight trade battles or you fight anything with friends. You know, it's always better, both theoretically and in practice, in horrible practice, as it were. So the answer to your question is, yes, ideally, this could be done in some sort of, I'm going to use this word again, I can't stand using it, holistic way, with partners. And so that's why you see things like what's called the Mineral Security Partnership at the Department of State. But those things are now being totally deprioritized. The idea there, and one of them started under the first Trump administration, called ERGI, the acronym Energy Resource Governance Initiative, I think. The idea there was exactly as you said, you know, can't we work with Canada and Australia in particular, and then other places, to both thwart Chinese influence, say in places like Indonesia or sub-Saharan Africa, while creating, what's the popular term in DC these days? It was under the last administration, friendshoring. You know, Americans love making up words. So this idea of friendshoring, which has a lot of sense to it, of course, you know, we do get a lot of this stuff from Canada and Australia, and why not? So that kind of security assumption has fallen under some disfavor right now with the advent of some tariffs, et cetera. But as an example, we get our most important trading partner for uranium is Canada. I mean, you could say it's also Kazakhstan, which is true, but, you know, Canada's a very important one, and as far as we can tell, and the DoD can tell, a very good friend. And, you know, under the last administration, part of the Defense Production Act monies actually went to Canadian firms because, you know, they're just north of Michigan and making some investments. So, you know, it matters how you think of the world, how much, and if you're operating under an America first, which we have been for some time, not just this administration, we have been for some time, then a deal like MP makes sense under that set of assumptions, because it's America. It's going to, you know, the magnets are going to come from Texas or somewhere else, and processing, et cetera, from California and Nevada. And so that would make a lot of sense. I just wanted to come back to one economic point, if you don't mind, John, on why it's so hard to get this stuff. So it goes back to one of your earlier points. If the stuff we're talking about is fairly abundant in the Earth's crust, in other words, you can get lithium from seawater, literally, but in very, you know, uneconomic ways right now. And of course, people are talking about deep sea nodules, which may be economic, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of this, these minerals around. The difficulty tends to be, at least in the United States, and for rare earths and other things, is that the markets for these things, as I said, are so small and that they're it's the actual processing plants, the smelters, say in out west here in Utah and Arizona, operate at a loss. So they have to actually buy stuff, copper, say, to process it. So they're actually operating at a loss. The only way you do that is by vertical integration. But the result is that the United States used to have, I think, 20 or 30 of these smelters, even back in the 1980s. Now we have two or three. And China has 50 or whatever the number is. And so if we don't make investments on that separation, processing, and refining, which is part of the deal with MP Materials, then there's no reason why the big mining companies or the operators of these things would ever build a smelter or operate it. So there's going to be, my guess is that there's going to be more of this money coming from DOD to focus on that direct problem. In other words, you have to pay the big mining companies enough to say, when you're going to get your copper out, we want you to put it into the processing refining system such that we also get out these 10 other minor metals or secondary or tertiary metals, other stuff we care about. Because otherwise, they're just going to say to you, who's going to pay for it? There's no investor. So we need both investment on the front end and offtake agreement.
You know, I know that you weren't necessarily working on these specific issues when you lived and worked abroad, but you've worked around Europe. You've studied and worked in Australia. How advanced are these same conversations happening in Canberra, in London, in Paris, in Berlin?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's a great question. And, you know, as you know, America, like most other countries, tends to be rather parochial in how it thinks of the world. And as a result of that sort of myopic view, what you do is, you know, you create things for you and you forget that the rest of the world exists. Of course, Japan has a critical minerals list. Australia has a critical minerals list. Canada has one. Europe, the various country member states in Europe have them. African countries have them, etc. And so these are global markets. These are global issues. Mm-hmm. Of course, the U.S., as a more militarized or heavily militarized country than a lot of others, has more of a focus on military armaments and building stuff than other countries. But they're thinking of it, you know, more aligned with, say, commercial uses. But also, you know, there are military concerns, of course, from NATO and other places, and, you know, relatively larger militaries that are building up, say Japan or Germany. And they're running into the same issues. In other words, so yes, but it is a kind of interesting to think about the list from Australia and Canada that are exporting countries for mining are fundamentally different from a math perspective than ours. So they focus on, you know, how much stuff can we export and to whom at what price and protect our economy. So that's a fundamentally different view than ours as a supply side security play. So all of those could benefit from more sophistication in looking at demand and looking at markets and looking at institutions, et cetera, et cetera. And those kind of analytical processes have been done in the energy sector. In other words, energy security is fairly sophisticated from a mathematical perspective, if you will, where the minerals markets really, or the critical mineral stuff really isn't in comparison. But, and this might be of some interest to your listeners, is the U.S., I'm aware of, I think, on the order of 7, 8, 9 different war games that were held just in the last year or two around these issues, around the exact issues we're talking about. And that's both military units, combatant commands, intelligence community, etc. And in some cases, you know, without saying anything classified, other countries were engaged in some way, or at least, you know, given some, at least they were part of the game,
sure,
one way or the other. So I think the international context is hugely important. But again, especially China. And I think it's important for people to understand too, that we're not just talking about minerals or materials. We are talking about advanced end products. So by far the most solar panels, which, you know, in America now have, again, the view that they're alternative or something, you know, fundamentally, they're just very elegant physics that Einstein got a Nobel Prize for, and the particle wave duality, that they require a lot of these minerals and metals, but China dominates their production. Same with wind turbines, same with batteries, same with electric vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. And all of those things have applications for U.S. military use,
sure,
from satellites that go into space to, you know, with photovoltaics on them, to, you know, the possibility for electrifying the joint force. You know, do you want batteries on bases? Do you want batteries in Humvees, et cetera, et cetera?
You know, there's kind of been an ongoing debate for quite some time, a number of years, but we've really seen it kick into high gear, given what we've seen in Ukraine, particularly with respect to unmanned platforms, because, you know, for 20 years, we had in countries like in Iraq and Afghanistan, U.S. military operations, coalition military operations with this unblinking eye above. And that unblinking eye came from very, very expensive and large UAVs, Predators and Reapers, $25 million a copy. Now we're seeing $1,000 DJI quadcopters repurposed to provide, to serve military purposes. And so this debate is between sort of a small number of sophisticated, exquisite, and very expensive platforms, or a large number of expendable platforms. Suffice it to say, we're not going to an all quadcopter Air Force. There's still going to be expensive, high-end things. And given the, you know, escalating prices, when the F-35s were rolling off, the first ones were rolling off the assembly lines, they were $90 or $100 million per aircraft. The AUKUS agreement, we've seen, hey, if we're going to undertake this expensive submarine building program, we're going to do it with partners. So there is this element of, I guess, this global element that's always going to be there. So, you know, would you say that the public discussion in the U.S., not necessarily the political discussion, but within the key stakeholders, does it sufficiently recognize the importance of doing this with allies and partners? Or, you know, is that maybe still yet to come?
Well, I think the political discourse does not do that. And I'm not signaling out the current administration for that. The political discourse, by virtue of our system and how you go about it, rhetoric of independence and America first, sure, is extremely powerful.
And always has been, yeah.
Always has been, right? So we've heard energy independence as a phrase, which in my view is a nonsense phrase, from every single president and head of Department of Energy for decades,
yeah,
everyone. So, yeah, you know, absolutely, having partners in this is essential. And I think that the Department of Defense, just to go back and emphasize that, is the best on that piece, because through horrible experience, the Department of Defense empirically understands that you do not want to fight alone. And so they understand working with partners every day in real pragmatic ways, for war fighting and for prevention, and for defense. So I think that the Department of Defense leading a lot of these critical minerals investments and therefore strategy, in other words, the money sort of leads the strategy in some cases, or where you have money, you have better strategy, is a good thing. And they'll be able to optimize and focus perhaps better than other departments that are more likely to have to, you know, play politics more. Of course, no one, assuming that you can get away with doing policy and investments without politics is naive. But you know, I'd like to think that the DoD investments over, including the current one, but that are likely upcoming and in the past have been done with those kind of wider global threats and opportunities in mind.
This multi-billion dollar public-private partnership, the DoD investment and commitments made to MP Materials, does it signal that that maybe shifting a bit? You know, as somebody who's worked on this for a long time, you know, when this news broke, it was probably for a lot of even defense generalists the first time they really kind of thought about some of this stuff. So I imagine that maybe there were times when you felt like you were kind of yelling into the void, trying to shake people by the, you know, by grab them by the lapels and shake them and tell them how important it is. Have you noticed sort of maybe a sea change just in terms of the appreciation of how important this is?
Yeah, look, it's definitely an inflection point of some kind. You know, history will tell us what level that is, but it's certainly a sea change. And I think, you know, I can tell you without giving away names, I was on a Marketplace and NPR. And so I was called by colleagues of yours or colleagues in the military field and in the industrial complex there saying, hey, do you know who made this deal? Like, which department is it? Who did it? What is it? Mm-hmm. And when I go through and explain the sort of multi-pronged piece of it, they're even more interested. And so yes, I think it's captured internally within the Pentagon and the apparatus, the imagination, and certainly people want to at least catch up on these topics. And so I think, you know, thanks for having me on. It's good timing for that. But we haven't seen anything like this. So for years, we've been seeing DPA Title III, Defense Production Act Title III investments. You know, we saw them, you know, a long time ago, often for steel, of course. And we wrote a detailed write-up of that. But, you know, you also saw MP Materials getting some of these smaller grants, or DPA grants, into the first Trump administration when we had rare earths on the DPA list. And then under Biden, it was used quite a few times. So it's not a short-term thing. In other words, MP Materials has been in discussion with the colleagues in the Pentagon in one shape or form, I would guess, for over 10 years. Mm. The narrative has always been relatively strong from a optics perspective. In other words, this is our rare earth place. China dominates rare earths. Why are we putting this stuff in a boat to send it to China to make it for us? So the narrative has always been fairly strong from a security perspective. Now, as I said, the investment itself is multi-pronged. So they actually bought what are called convertible shares, but they bought equity in the company. Well, they did buy it, and once it's converted and once the deal is done, that's about 15% of the company. So that means some level of control, and part of the deal, I'm sure, had to do with the shape of the board and all kinds of corporate stuff. So that's one part. And then we talked about the offtake, the price floor, the loans for separation. You know, so it's certainly multi-pronged. And then again, what you saw was a very highly orchestrated set of press releases from companies that the American public has heard of, like Goldman Sachs and Apple. Yeah. So we saw all of that. Now, of course, like with any deal, there are risks to these kind of, you know, heavy government picking winners, industrial policy type decisions. And especially in a market economy like the United States. So you've already seen, you know, some so-called capitalists or pure capitalists, or I'm not sure what they call themselves, saying that, you know, this deal doesn't make sense from that perspective. You just picked one company. What about the other companies? So there's some risk there. That's a more market risk for the future for the other companies. And you have, of course, political risk, which never goes away. In other words, does the next administration try to unwind this or unwind pieces and parts of this? And this sort of nagging thing that we think about a lot at the Colorado School of Mines is that you also have sort of delivery risk in terms of, do you have the trained people to do this stuff? And can you make these big industrial products at scale in light of existing competition with China, right? So I would just say that those people who think that China is somehow cheering us on or slowing down while we speed up are not paying attention, because they're speeding up their investments. In fact, they're putting, you know, billions, even more than that, into this space. And so there's an ongoing competition with China that does not go away.
So to sort of wrap up, I wonder if we can kind of zoom out and just if we think in terms of how we conceptualize this problem, such as it is the objective to sort of build something that effectively completely eliminates our dependence on Chinese controlled supply chains and any attendant risk associated with that dependence on those supply chains? Or is it really about sort of graduated and incremental degrees of becoming slightly less vulnerable?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is it has to be the latter. It's very difficult to conceive of an optimization function that puts in as its constraints that we will be totally isolated from global supply chains and commercial markets. That's not how the world works these days, or any longer, if it ever did. And so what you try to do with any kind of optimization, as you know, is take a system boundary that's optimizable with a set of constraints that are sort of reasonable to get to your function, to your whatever that is. In this case, maybe the optimization is for best security or best resilience or best ability to meet the mission of war fighting or defense. And I think in those cases, if you make the problem smaller, there are some possibilities that, and I think you're going to see this coming up, other focused investments on key things where a relatively modest amount of money can make a difference in a global market. Again, you can't do that for oil, right? You can't make a modest investment and do anything. You have to make massive investment. In these cases, you know, you might see something with gallium or germanium or antimony or tungsten, even so some other investments where at least the DoD is satisfied that, you know, to meet a 3-5 year war game scenario, that they'll be okay, that they can get what they need. But trying to solve for the entire economy, for the commercial set of the economy, is a much different mathematical problem and a different political one.
Sure. Well, Morgan, thank you again. These have been fascinating insights. You've really shed a lot of really important light on a complex but really interesting sort of problem set.
My pleasure, John.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.